Professor Christian Schutz is an assistant professor of psychology here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She got her PhD in 2006 from Harvard University. Her area of research is about the development of social categories and preferences in early childhood and trying to understand how people create categories for things like gender, race, social class, and how those things are informed by the culture that a person is raised in. I first heard about Kristen, found her when someone said, hey, you should take a look at these grant recipients. So in 2012, Kristen was awarded a gratitude research grant from the University of California, Davis and the John Templeton Foundation, basically for the research she was doing, but the grant is designed to help expand the scientific understanding of gratitude and how gratitude works. And so I was looking through these neat research studies that people were doing, and lo and behold, I found a UW-Madison professor amongst all of these, you know, very well-recognized researchers from Berkeley and Harvard, and I was like, sweet. And then I asked her if she would speak for us, and she said yes. So that's how we got her. And I recently was looking over some of the studies she was doing. She's actually done a wide breadth of different research on how children perceive people with disabilities and without disabilities, how children relate to food and how people tell them how to relate to food. And she actually did a study. Did you actually go to South Africa for this study to see how race can create a preference in children? And they actually went to South Africa to perform the study, which is a majority black country, to see if it was really race or if it was also tied into socioeconomic status. Anyways, there's a lot of really cool research out there that she has done. I'd like to invite her up, and I'll plug in my machine, and she'll give us a talk.
So I'm going to end the talk by talking about some of my own work, but I thought in the spirit of the topic for today, I'd actually review some of the more general things that we know about children's cooperative tendencies and the origins of those things. So that's where we'll start, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what we're trying to do in my lab now. So humans are amazingly cooperative. We work together to achieve things that no single person could achieve on their own, including, as a shout out to the song, which I didn't know about, the pyramids. And beyond the things around us as evidence for human cooperation, there are tons of studies by social scientists demonstrating human adults' capacity to engage in pro-sociality across a wide range of situations. But what I'd like today to focus primarily on are creatures who maybe aren't capable of doing some of the things like this on the slide yet, but who are nevertheless engaged members of their social communities, and namely as children. And I also think that studies of children together with studies of non-human animals, which I won't focus on today, but those together can shed light on the evolutionary and developmental origins of achievements like these. So evolution involves a pretty intense competition between individuals for survival and passing on of genes. Yet we nevertheless observe cooperative behavior in primates as well as in members, other members of the animal kingdom. I've just chosen two baby vampire bats as an example of a case where you see sharing between members of the species. And that pair of facts, that tension between this motivation to kind of continue on our own genes versus help other members of our species, has really fascinated evolutionary biologists for decades. And scientists have proposed a number of mechanisms to explain the evolution of cooperation, and I've listed just some of them here. But one idea is that we evolve to help others because helping our kin helps pass along our own genes to the extent that we share those genes with members of our families. But we also cooperate with people we're not related to, and so another idea is that the evolution of cooperative behavior was favored by the probability of future mutual interactions. So if you're going to have repeated encounters with somebody, you might prefer to cooperate rather than defect, because ultimately you'll kind of get back what you gave into a relationship. A third idea is that helping someone establishes good reputation, so you become known as a helpful person, and that gets rewarded by others, and that's one reason we tend to cooperate. And yet a fourth idea is that people help others because doing so helps their group, and a group of cooperators is likely to succeed over the course of time rather than a group of defectors. So those are just some of the explanations, and if you read different articles or theories, you'll see people favoring one over the other, although I'll point out that it's possible that all of those and more provided mechanisms for supporting cooperative tendencies in humans. But whatever the mechanisms are, if it's true that human evolved these tendencies to be pro-social toward others, you might expect to find evidence of those tendencies in the youngest members of our species, and in fact, you do. So I'll go through some of the findings just to illustrate that point. So one is that children show concern for others very early in development. So when newborn infants hear another infant crying, they become distressed and start crying themselves. And it's not just because they hate the noise, and it's not just because they hate crying, because they don't do it when they're played recordings of their own crying. So it seems specifically like they're reacting to or particularly distressed by crying of other infants. As early as their first birthday, actually, even though the child in this picture is a little older than that, children also take steps to comfort other people who are in distress. So if somebody's crying or if somebody's hurt themselves by running into a podium, you see very young children, as young as a year of age, walking over to the person to comfort them, patting them on the back or rubbing the area of injury or giving them a hug or trying to kiss them. I'm sure if you've been around children, you've had the opportunity to observe some of those moments, and they're particularly endearing. Toddlers also readily help other people achieve their goals. As demonstrated most clearly and perhaps most acutely by studies conducted at the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig. So I'll show you four examples of helping on the part of an 18-month-old, but some of the simple behaviors that you'll see here are present even a few months earlier in development. So here are four examples of, cute examples, of kids actually helping somebody else in need. Oh, they're all in German. Ha ha ha! when seeing behaviors like that or more natural behaviors in the real world, whether those sorts of helping behaviors are really natural or intrinsic or spontaneous on the part of young children, or whether children are doing it because they've been rewarded to do it in the past, so a more socialization kind of perspective. And that's a difficult question to answer, especially because, you know, the children in these studies are toddlers and they've had some time to participate in the social world. But I think there are a few pieces of evidence that children aren't doing it simply for a reward. First is there doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence from naturalistic observations that parents give a lot of rewards to children for helping. They certainly acknowledge those acts, but it's not like every time a child picks up a napkin off the floor, somebody's like, oh, hold on, that's worth $5, and is running over to give them these kinds of rewards. The second piece of evidence is when researchers do the same kind of studies that I just showed you before, but they manipulate what the parent is doing, so the person who would have, you know, been most present in the child's life and maybe doing that kind of socialization or rewarding, kids don't really seem to care about whether the parent is present or encouraging them or not. So here are rates of helping in three different cases. So in a kind of pre-phase before the experiment, or sorry, during the actual experiment, they manipulate what the parent is doing. In one case, the parent is actively encouraging the child, like, go over there and help that person, come on, go do that. In another case, the parent was passively observing, so just watching what the child was doing in the room. In another case, the parent was completely absent, so not in the room at all when the child was given an opportunity to help. And what you can see is that rates of helping are high overall. But in fact, they're quite high when parents aren't in the room at all and certainly aren't actively encouraging them and aren't even present. These young children are highly likely to provide help even when their parents are not in the room to say good job or give them a reward. The other interesting thing is that when you do reward children for helping, it doesn't seem particularly effective if what you want to do is increase their helping behavior. So when people repeated the same study I showed you before, where children were given opportunities to help, and they preceded it by kind of a pre-phase where children received either verbal praise for helping somebody, no reaction for helping somebody, or actually material rewards like candies or stickers for helping somebody, and then they went and measured toddlers' willingness to help again in the future, what they found is that those who received a neutral response and those who received verbal praise were highly likely to help later on, but those who received the material rewards for helping actually were less likely to help later on. And so not only do you see the rewards actually decreasing children's kind of natural proclivity to help, you also see in the case of the first two bars that praising a child for helping and then asking whether that will make them help more later doesn't seem to change their behavior. And perhaps the most compelling case for the idea that human socialization is at least not necessary for the sorts of helping behaviors I showed you comes from studies of chimpanzees, who in fact will help someone out if they can't reach an object. So here's a similar study conducted between a chimpanzee and the person that the chimps spend the most time with, their handler. Actually engaging in the same kinds of behaviors that human children were, and certainly it's not the case that these chimpanzees are living in homes and getting rewarded for doing all this helping after dinner. So please suggest that that's not necessary for us to observe these kinds of helping behaviors. The tendency to be pro-social is also seen across different kinds of situations. So we also see prosociality when it comes to children sharing resources. So as one example, if preschoolers are given the job of helping someone else, in this case a doll, distribute resources to other people, they tend to do so in an egalitarian manner. So for example, if there are four dolls in need of something and there are four resources, children don't take them all and just pile them in front of one doll that they might like better than the others. rather they tend to distribute resources in a one-to-one manner, so everybody gets one. And in a second study, researchers showed that it's also the case that when children themselves stand to gain or lose something, so they're not helping some dog give out resources, but rather they're actually giving up their own resources, children can be quite generous. So in one study, three-year-olds work together to open up a kind of complicated apparatus that they have to work really hard to get into, and that apparatus contained different rewards, for example, four gummy bears. Very rewarding for three-year-olds. And after that, the researchers measured what children did with the spoils of their collaborative work. And what most of them did was share the resources equally, two for the one child and two for the other child, even in cases where it would have been really easy for one kid to dominate all the resources because they were clumped closer to one child or the other. That's not what happens. It's as if kids are saying, hey, we work together, we have to squeeze things out, let's go ahead and divide them up equally. And that was the most common tendency you saw among children. Now, all these behaviors are really nice, and it's particularly interesting to see them emerging in children who are very young. But it's worth noting, just to be perfectly fair about the evidence, that kids aren't always running around helping all people at all times and being completely selfless. You may have noticed this if you spent time around children. And in fact, that point about selectivity is related to the mechanisms I was talking about before by which cooperative tendencies may have evolved in the first place. So we know, for example, that young children tend to be more generous toward family members than toward those they don't know very well. They also tend to give more resources to friends than to people who they don't like very much. And they also tend to give more to members of their social in-group. So for example, if an experimenter tells them that they're dividing up resources and they can give things to somebody who goes to their school or somebody who doesn't go to their school, children are more likely to give more stuff to kids who go to their school than to kids who don't go to their school. And that kind of selectivity doesn't seem like a big deal when you're talking about favoring your friends or your family or favoring people who have been nice to you in the past rather than somebody who hasn't been particularly nice. Those all seem like really natural, normal things to be doing. But in my lab, we've also started to see cases where we see that selectivity emerging in cases where children haven't met anybody who they're presented with the opportunity to share resources between. So to just take one example, in a recent study with preschool-aged children in Madison, most of whom were white, we found that children were more generous toward people from their racial in-group versus people from a racial out-group, even though they never met any of the people they were giving things to before. So here's what trials in this study tended to look like. Kids saw a bunch of them. This is just one example. And we also varied what side different people were on and so forth. So it's not just that kids like to give more to the person on the left or to the right. So what happened is that children saw photographs of one African-American child next to one white child and were given little coins to distribute to the kids. And we told participants that the coins could be used to buy really awesome prizes later, so we gave them a little bit of value. And what we found is that they tended to distribute these coins in a way that favored unfamiliar white children over equally unfamiliar black children, even though we did provide them with a way to be equal, which is in the case of giving three, we said, you know what, if you don't want to give all of them away, you can always just set one aside in this box here and we'll put it away. So they could have distributed the resources in an equal manner. But we also gave them cases where they just had two resources and two people. And in cases where those two individuals differed in race, we saw some children actually, and as the group on the whole, giving more resources to their racial in-group members than to racial out-group members. Now, before kind of interpreting that, I think it's worth pointing out that we don't see evidence of this sort of race-based favoritism early in development. So, for example, we know that 10-month-old infants are equally interested in interacting with individuals who match their racial group identity versus individuals who don't. And this is shown really cutely in studies where two people come up and they will smile at and talk to the child, and then both of them reach out toward the child and maybe out for a toy or out for their hands. And what we find is that babies don't seem to use race as a basis to make those decisions. They certainly see differences in skin color, that's been shown in other studies, but they don't seem to use it to guide their social decisions. In fact, in another study, even 2.5-year-old children, when they were presented with individuals who differed in race and were given a resource to distribute between them, tended to distribute resources equally. So we're starting to see a change over development, where very early in life, kids don't seem to care very much about skin color, and later on in the preschool years, they're kind of developing a concern for that distinction and using it to guide some social behaviors. So clearly something is developing. I think there are probably many explanations for what's developing, but I think one plausible idea based on these data is that children over development might learn that when they need something, that help is more likely to come from a racial in-group member than a racial out-group member. And that's not because that's if children took a population view that that would be true, but in their local experiences, especially if they're raised in a more homogenous community, the kinds of help that they're getting from their family members, extended relatives, you know, peers around the neighborhood, might tend to come more often from racial in-group members than racial out-group members over the course of time. And one piece of evidence in favor of that idea is that we found that the kids who were more apt to share with in-group versus out-group members were also the same kids who, when we asked, said that they expected more resources from in-group members than from out-group members, or they expected to get help from children who belong to their racial in-group or their racial out-group. So one possibility is that expectations about who might help them or give to them might be driving their distribution behaviors. So we're actually trying many different strategies to see if we can address that kind of early racial in-group favoritism that we see and see how malleable children's behaviors are. But one is inspired by the finding about expectations is in fact related to the grant that Naomi alluded to on gratitude. And so we're asking whether if having positive experiences receiving help from members of diverse racial backgrounds might actually change children's attitudes and behaviors. So in this particular game, which I screenshotted, the child's task is to just drag little objects to the bottom of the screen to complete the puzzle. And at one point, they've discovered that they're missing a little shape that they need to complete the level, and they're allowed to call for help. And the person who always answers and provides the help is somebody who does not match their own racial group membership. And we're interested in whether that changes children's attitudes toward members of different groups and also their behavior toward those groups. And so far, we have some promising effects from this intervention, but the work is still ongoing. So stay tuned, or invite me back in 5 years and we will be done. There is a case, though, where we recently observed children acting against what we normally think of their social preferences when distributing resources to unfamiliar people. So we know that beginning around 4 or 5 years, children show preferences in favor of unfamiliar people who appear to be higher in socioeconomic status versus people who appear to be lower in socioeconomic status. And that's something we've been finding a number of times in studies. But in a recent study, I had a thesis student who was interested in how children would distribute resources to people who seemed to vary in socioeconomic status. So what happened in this study was that participants who were all school-aged were introduced to a series of pictures of unfamiliar children, and they were each paired with different descriptions, some of which were meant to connote higher wealth, and some of which were meant to connote lower wealth. And we gave participants resources to distribute to these children, and we measured how many things they tended to give to children who had been paired with higher or lower wealth descriptions. So if you hear about a child who has the first story associated with her versus the second story, do you actually, when you're allowed to give out resources yourself, do you actually give more to one person than the other, or do you give equally? And what we found was that children, regardless of their own family's household income, which we measured on a questionnaire, tended to be more generous toward those who were described with those low wealth facts than those who were described with those high wealth descriptions. And you can see that from the green bars here, that's giving to the target children when they were described with those low wealth stories versus the higher wealth stories. And on the horizontal axis, you see the income from the participants themselves. And you can see that even participants who come from families who make higher incomes also recognize that when they're in a position to give out resources and all they know about children are these stories about what their financial backgrounds of their families might be, tend to actually give more resources or be more generous when the child might appear to be in need versus when the child appears to have more resources themselves. Okay, so to kind of round things up, my goal was in this brief talk as a part of this longer service was to give you some evidence that children show some really early proclivities for pro-social behavior. Namely, they show early concern for others' well-being, as demonstrated in that newborn crying and comforting study. Second, they tend to give spontaneous help to people. When people manifest that they need something, children tend to approach those people, provide help, and seem to get a lot of joy out of doing that. They seem very happy when they're in those positions. And they also tend to willingly share resources in a manner that seems fair, and especially after collaborating with an individual, they don't run and take all the gummy bears and peace out. They actually say, hey, the right thing to do here would be to divide these up equally. On the other hand, and in as compatible with theories about the evolution of cooperation, we also see children showing some selectivity here in favor of members of their family or friends, as well as social in-groups over social out-groups. On the other hand, we see some nuance there, such that children are giving more resources to those who appear to need more resources, namely those who might come from a background that suggests that they have fewer resources themselves. So it's kind of a complicated picture of this really early tendency to be generous, to be helpful, and to be spontaneously engaging in social ways with members of the community and being helpful, but also showing some selectivity in that process over the course of development. So I hope that in addition to giving you a taste of what children's pro-social tendencies look like, I've also met a second goal, which is to convince you that research in child development is really interesting and informative. And if you're interested in learning more or in having your child participate, you can visit our lab's website. All the papers from all of our research are posted there along with descriptions of them. And our lab, which you'd be welcome to visit, is at the Wiesman Center on campus. And we also do short studies with children in the Madison Children's Museum in the Cozy Cottage. So if you ever see research going on there, you should come by and say hi to us. So with that, I will end and turn things back over to Naomi.
Okay, so this is airing and sharing. So you guys get to say whatever you want. If you want to give a comment about Kristen's research or about Sunday Assembly, I'm going to start setting up the laptop again so that we can get that going. But if anybody wants to jump in, just raise your hand. Leslie's running for you.
Thank you. that have been done on children have involved a possible danger for helping, or something that would be detrimental to them. So, for example, they had to give up a treat or something like that. And what would be the difference in the results of that if it was something negative as a result from helping?
I don't know that there have been studies that have precisely compared young children to adults on that dimension, in part because it's hard if you think about what it child likes and has to give up versus an adult. But certainly as adults, we give up things that would be beneficial to us to help other people, like we donate to causes to help people who we've never met before. We're giving up resources that we could spend on ourselves and helping other people. And in fact, in those same kinds of studies with toddlers, they found that if children were engaged in this really exciting game and a person needed help, and so needing to give them help meant giving up this fun game that they were engaged in, that children are willing to give up some of their time or give up playing with a toy to help somebody else out, at least in these kinds of scenarios. So kind of what that calculus is exactly between children and adults, I'm not sure, but you certainly see both patterns of behavior in early development and later development. It's just harder work to do because it requires building up a large sample of kids who have those experiences and looking at how, you know, what their behaviors look like. But I think that would be really interesting. We are also interested in looking at children of parents who maybe have many cross-race friends and asking when children, you know, grow up in that kind of an environment and see their parents making friends from different social groups, how that impacts their own preferences and behavior, which is another way of kind of asking about that early experience. And it is, I don't think it's true that, you know, that our tendencies to give more to others go completely away. I mean, in part, right, we cannot possibly help every person at all times on this planet, right? We have limited resources, we have limited time. And so part of what, you know, we have to do is figure out where are we going to devote those resources and time. And we can talk about, you know, the moral implications of choosing some groups over others, but we have to figure out some way to do that, because if we ran around the world just completely always giving off our time and never sleeping and giving away all of our resources, that's not a workable way to live. So it seems that one thing that people sometimes do is tend to favor members of their social in-groups as a way of solving that problem of, like, I can't give to everybody, who should I give